Mr. Milner, would you proceed?
Yes, may it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Milner, and with me today is my co-counsel, David Goodman. We represent Capital Wires LP and its general partner, Eyesight Management, the appellants. The appellants are here today asking the court to overturn a summary judgment granted by the trial court, enforcing a contract as a contract, a preliminary proposal from the FLE as a gas well operator to Capital Wireless to participate in the gas well as a non-operator when that proposal lacked definitive terms on such basic items as the specific types and categories of costs and expenses the non-operator is obligated to pay, what, if any, share of the those chargeable costs and expenses the non-operator would be responsible to pay, how those expenses are to be accounted for, allocated, and disclosed, and when payments are due. Now, the trial court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of appellee on the proposal because the absence of these essential material terms make the proposal unenforceable on its face. Alternatively, the competent, non-objectionable summary judgment evidence, when considered in the light most favorable to the appellants as the non-movements, raise a genuine issue of material fact as to the existence of a meeting of the minds between the parties on the terms of the non-operator's participation. You know, alternatively, the proposal is ambiguous as to whether it was intended as a final and binding agreement, leaving a genuine issue of material fact as to the party's intent. Now, the document, the alleged contract that is in issue is a December 2nd, 2009 letter to the non-operator requesting that the non-operator elect to participate in a particular well referred to as the Edwards 21X28. This alleged contract, which I'll refer to as the drilling proposal, indicated that the well in question would have a December 9, 2009 spud date just a week later and request a response from the non-operator within 30 days of whether it's going to elect to participate. That letter in the drilling proposal also specifically states that a proposed joint operating agreement is going to be forthcoming. It has attached to it a list of some initial determinations of the percentage interest of the working interest owners, but it specifically says that those interests listed are subject to a final division order title opinion. It also has attached to it.
You say on page 7 of your reply brief, the percentages listed were expressly acknowledged to be subject to future agreement in division orders. It doesn't say, well, tell me where it says that, future agreement, like there was going to be some negotiation going on.
As to the division,
percentages.
Okay, well, the overall agreement, and if I misstated in my brief, I certainly apologize, but the language just says that it is subject to a final division or a title opinion. When you take the drilling proposal as a whole and look at it, because it lacks all these essential terms and it lacks a definitive statement as to what that working percentage interest is, I think the entirety of the terms of the participation are subject to future agreement.
Well, isn't the purpose of the final title opinion just to update the working interests and other interests of royalty owners and so forth? Wouldn't your client already have known it had 12.5% working interest?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the interest in the title is a legal determination or is a question of law, and it's a question of the title as it appears in the title records, but certainly, they could come out with a final division order title opinion, and it could be wrong, and they could, in the the non-operators could say, no, that's not correct, and challenge that fact. Now, even if a final division order title opinion were to come out, the problem that we face here is that we've got this drilling proposal lacked terms that said, it lacked any operative terms that said, well, what are the categories of costs and expenses that specifically are going to be chargeable to these non-operators? You know, well, what's not chargeable to the non-operators?
But again, your client had to execute and return a copy of the AFE, which didn't it list the expenses?
Certainly, it lists expenses on there. It lists categories of expenses. But nowhere in this drilling proposal is there any statement as to, okay, which of these are going to be chargeable, which are non-chargeable, or what portion of these is this non-operator going to be responsible for? When you look at the document in its totality, it lacks these terms. It lacks the definitive terms that say, here is what is that operator or non-operator is obligated to do. That's the type of definitive terms that are required for an enforceable contract to be determined. And that's what the appellee, as the movement on summary judgment, because this is a summary judgment case, was required to show to meet its burden on summary judgment. And when you take these lack of terms as to, again, the cost and expenses, what share of those costs and expenses are going to be charged, how are they going to be accounted for, what type of audit rights are these non-operators going to have, when are payments even going to be due? It doesn't say that. You take that along with the statements in the drilling proposal that say, you know, there's going to be a proposed joint operating agreement that's forthcoming. There's going to needs to be a final division order title opinion. It's clear that those subsequent documents are necessary to set forth the enforceable terms of whatever the scope of this participation is going to be. Now, the appellee has argued that some of these terms can be inferred or read into the agreement, but quite frankly, based on industry custom and practice, but the appellants would assert that can't be done on this record. The industry custom and usage and practice have to be established by competent evidence that's in the record. And there is no evidence in this record before the court, or that was before the trial court for summary judgment, of what any industry custom was in terms of what that AFE means, how it's used. They argue that it's that the generally accepted meaning is that it's, they're supposed to pay, the non-operator pays a pro rata share of all the costs and expenses. Well, it doesn't say that on the document itself, and there's no evidence presented of that as an industry custom. So those fall away, and it cannot support summary judgment. Now, at the very least, when you take these circumstances, you take this the document, the lack of the terms, the statements in there about future documentation, at the very least, there is a fact question that remained when you view all this evidence in light most favorable to the appellants as a non-movement. There's a question of fact as to whether the parties intended to enter into an enforceable agreement as opposed to an agreement to agree in the future. And that question of intent, of the parties' intent to enter into an enforceable agreement, it's well established, both the Farika case and also the Scott versus Engel Brothers Pacific Inc. both say that that is a question of fact that remains, and there's no evidence in the record on that issue, and that precluded the trial court from entering a summary judgment.
Well, really, you just want us to decide that, because you didn't submit any summary judgment evidence, correct?
That is correct.
So your belief is that the documents speak for themselves, the proposal, the letter that was signed, and the AFE. And what is it in those two documents that show that you were conditioning your acceptance of their offer on something that's happening in the future, that you're making it subject to something that's happening in the future?
Well, Your Honor, that is not necessarily the position that appellants are taking. What the appellants are saying is that the appellee failed to meet the burden that when you view that document on its face and you compare the statement about it, it says a proposed joint operating agreement is forthcoming. So we know that the document's coming, and we compare that to the fact that these essential terms that I've mentioned are lacking in the document. Because there's a lack of those terms, and when you take those together, they haven't met the burden to show that this is an enforceable agreement because it creates a fact issue. The evidence they submitted still leaves a fact issue as to whether this is intended to be an enforceable agreement. And it's clear that that is a fact question that would preclude summary judgment. Now,
is there any evidence in the record, summary judgment record, as to when demand was made for payment?
I do not believe that there.
Or when the well was completed?
Your Honor, I'll be quite frank that I don't recall there being any, but I certainly could not point to where in the record that appeared.
Okay.
And I don't recall seeing it in the record.
Just curious.
Yeah. In addition to these issues, there are also some evidentiary objections that have been raised by the appellants, and the objections were asserted, but there was no express ruling by the trial court on those objections. Appellants would argue that because the summary judgment order, since the appellee's evidence is the only evidence that was presented, the statement within the summary judgment order that the court reviewed the appellee's definitely can infer the fact that there was a implied overruling of those objections. But even if the court doesn't agree with that, a number of the objections that were raised were as to the legally and factually conclusory statements of Mr. Higgins, the appellee's landman, and his affidavit. And those are defects of substance, and those can be raised for the first time on appeal. And so the examples of this, or the objections specifically, fall into a few different categories, most notably the percentage working interest. There are several places where Mr. Higgins testifies as to what the percentage interest of the appellants is. And title is a question of law, and so that's a legally conclusory statement. Plus, he does not back that up with any factual statements. If he's going to come in and make a conclusory statement or a statement like that, he has to be able to show what it is, you know, how he came to that conclusion. There's no evidence in the record or submitted with his affidavit showing any title documents or explaining how he came to that conclusion about the percentage. And that is reversible error because, again, the drilling proposal lacks a definitive statement as to what percentage interest there are for the non-operator. And so if the court had to rely on that the statements and testimony from Mr. Higgins, that probably led to resulted in an improper judgment. There are also objections to statements that Mr. Higgins made regarding the meaning and legal effect of the drilling proposal, particularly as the appellee has argued about the fact that it means that the non-operator is responsible for a pro rata share of all the costs and expenses. Well, that's not in the document, and he is testifying as to the meaning of that document, and that's a legal conclusion. It's improper. There's also statements where he summarizes statements by Mr. Shanks, representative of the appellants, without actually citing to or saying here is what Mr. Shanks said. He just gives a summary, and that's conclusory because it doesn't give the supporting facts, which are the actual statements made by Mr. Shanks. So I see my time is running out. For these reasons, I would ask that this summary judgment by the trial court be reversed.
Okay, thank you. Lawyer from the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. Justice Gardner, the demand letter was dated December 15th of 2010. I think the first invoice was in April. It's referred to in paragraph 7 of Mr. Higgins' affidavit, and I'm sorry I don't have the actual clerk's record reference for that, but the demand letter itself was attached as Exhibit 4.
Okay.
The issue here is whether there was a binding contract for Capital to pay its share of the drilling and completion costs for the test well. XTO sought the participation of the unit working interest owners, and under North Dakota law, a non-operator lessee like Capital who does not agree to participate may be assessed a risk penalty equal to 200% of that party's proportionate share of the costs in addition to its share of the costs themselves. Capital agreed to participate and avoided a risk penalty of approximately $1.3 million. After XTO incurred the cost, Capital took the position that there never was an agreement to participate at all, and it did not pay its share. The appellant's arguments are based on the premise that the participation agreement does not contain the essential terms, but it does. And a copy of the agreement is attached to our brief under tab A. It provides that XTO, as the operator, will drill and complete the test well. It describes the type of well. It was a single lateral horizontal well. It contained detail descriptions of the locations of the well bore, the planned drilling depths, and it included an AFE containing almost 70 categories of drilling and completion costs to be incurred for a total amount of $5,334,000. The AFE describes the types of costs to be incurred.
Where in the participation agreement or the AFE does it say that Capital agrees to pay its pro rata costs?
I think, Your Honor, the number one, Capital agrees by signing the letter. Capital expressly elected to participate, limited to its working interest. Well, that can have no other meaning that its participation is based on its proportionate share of its working interest. And then I think also if you take that in connection with Capital signing the AFE under a block that's labeled non-operator approval, those two facts and the objective manifestation of signing those two in those two places clearly evidences an agreement to pay its share of the cost based on what its working interest is. And it's important to keep in mind that an AFE means an authorization for expenditure, and the appellants kind of ignore that. We cite in our brief on page 11, in addition to a couple of cases, we cite to the Smith and Weaver oil and gas treatise, and Professor Smith states that a party who agrees to the AFE is committed to participating in the operations set out therein, even though it proves more costly than initially anticipated. The participation agreement contained the essential terms, and it's a binding agreement. And Justice Gabriel, you're absolutely correct. There's nothing in it that creates some condition on the participation agreement being binding only if the parties sign a formal joint operating agreement that would be sent in the future.
Well, you mentioned that participation of Capital would be limited to the working interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of it. But and is what you're referring to reflected by the X on the second page of the letter that they sent back saying elect to participate in the drilling and completion of Edward so forth limited to the working interest of the undersigned party? That does expressly say what you just said.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason why it's worded that way is that this letter is not just sent to one party. It was sent to all of the non-operating unit working interest owners. So it was set up for each, the undersigned party, each working interest owner, to make the election or not. We have cited the court on the issue of whether, you know, the appellants are arguing in essence that the participation agreement, the binding effect of that, was conditioned on signing a formal JOA. And we've cited the court to the MCRB and Hardman cases. And in each of those cases, the courts of appeals affirm a summary judgment holding that a letter agreement was enforceable because it was not conditioned on the parties signing other documents that were referenced in the letter agreement. And the MCRB case is a good example. That dealt with a letter agreement for the lease of railway cars. And the document that was referenced in the letter agreement that the appellant in that case was saying prevented there from being a binding agreement, that document was the form of the master lease itself. And the court held that the letter agreement was binding because it was not conditioned. There was no manifestation of intent in the letter agreement to make it conditioned on the party signing another agreement.
Well, here it does say, it's sort of troubling to see this sentence, but that in the letter to the interest owners, a proposed joint operating agreement will be forthcoming. That sounds like there is an intent to have the terms later reduced to an agreement.
That's, well, and I think, you know, a formal agreement. JOA is usually a very comprehensive document, and it's designed to cover future operations, other wells. It's designed to cover, in essence, the entire relationship or anticipated relationship. But that in and of itself does not make it a prerequisite to having an enforceable agreement for the parties to participate just as to this activity, the drilling and completion of a test well. And so what the cases say, and other courts, such as the WTG gas case, which is at 309 Southwest 3rd, 635, and the John Wood Group case at 26 Southwest 3rd, page 12, quote the Farnsworth treatise on contracts, which states that a party who does not wish to be prematurely bound by a letter agreement should include a provision clearly stating that the letter is non-binding. And the reason for that rule makes perfect sense, because if you have a party signing a letter agreement, and if the party does not clearly state in it that it is not intending to be bound by what he's agreeing to, or even that there may be other terms that it is a necessity and a prerequisite that the other terms be agreed to before it's binding, if there is none of that, then the other party to the agreement will rely on the objective manifestation of the intent to be bound and will act on it. And that's what happened here. Capital signed the participation agreement, and XTO relied on that and proceeded with incurring the drilling and completion costs.
Mark.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm looking at the reply letter from David Shanks that went to Mr. Jake Higgins. That's Exhibit B to your brief. And the only thing to me that I read into that letter that's left open and by referencing back to a provision that's in the last paragraph of the December 2nd, 2009 letter, it's referencing the title opinion. And it says in the offering letter, I'm going to call it December 2nd, 2009, that a proposed joint venture, joint operating agreement will be forthcoming, and please be advised that a drilling title opinion has been prepared and is currently being updated. If you want a copy, send it to me. Tell us and we'll send it to you. And it says in here that he wants a copy. What summary judgment evidence was there, if there was any, that dealt with any dispute in the title as to the spacing unit?
There's no summary judgment whatsoever. The only summary judgment evidence is that Capital owns a 12.5% working interest in the unit. At the time Capital signed the participation agreement, the first page of the agreement says that there is a drilling title opinion that's already been done, and it shows 12.5% interest for Capital. And the agreement contains the list of the working interest owners. It shows Capital has a 12.5% interest. Capital initialed that page in the agreement.
So, I'm looking at that, and that's what I was asking you about. If you look at the very top part of the very top page of on the 34th page, it's marked as part of the exhibits, 33, 32, 33, 34, right at the top on 34. It says, based on initial title opinion, subject to final division order title opinion.
Correct.
And does, was there, is there summary judgment evidence that shows a updated title opinion was furnished to Capital Wireless after it was completed, like was contemplated in the original letter?
No, Your Honor, there's not. The updated title opinion is not in the record. There's no evidence of any complaint subsequent to the letter agreement.
Well, that's my next question, was what evidence is there of a contention that the 12.5% working interest was wrong?
There's none.
All right.
There's no evidence. And clearly, at the time that Capital signs the participation agreement, it's willing to participate at 12.5% interest. And that is all that it was ever charged. You can look, all of the invoices are in the record, and every one of them assesses the Capital's proportionate share at a 12% interest. There's no evidence of any objection to that, other than after the, you know, Capital just taking the position that there's not an agreement. The evidence, if I can just briefly touch on, I see my time is finishing. The Capital, in their reply brief, claims that there has to be evidence of the COPAS accounting procedures. And even assuming that accounting procedures would be an essential term of the agreement, but even assuming that's right, the appellant's argument just mixes apples and oranges. They are claiming that there is no agreement because there's a missing term as to accounting. And the law says, no, you can't claim that there's no agreement because industry custom will supply that term. Now, if Capital were complaining about a charge and saying, this charge right here, you didn't account for that properly, well, then evidence of a COPAS accounting procedure would address that. But that's not what the question is here. It's simply Capital or appellants claiming that there's no agreement at all. It's consistent with a party claiming, well, there's no agreement at all because there's not a time of performance stated. And the courts say, no, that's not right. As a matter of law, there is an agreement, and the courts will supply a reasonable time. I see my time's up.
I have a question for you, even though your time's up.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's reference in the December 2nd 209 letter to North Dakota law, the premise where the test well was being drilled was in the North Dakota debacle. And then the exchange of letters is between people in Texas. And when we go through and look at the brief, what's cited is Texas law.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I take it everyone agreed and didn't dispute in the trial court that Texas law controlled the contractual aspects of what's happening between the parties, and that the only implication of the law of North Dakota would have been an imposed penalty upon a non-participant.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think we're dealing with a contract here between two entities that reside in Fort Worth, Texas. And I think the parties, but I will, just to complete the answer, if I may, North Dakota law would not call for a different result as to the contract issue. And if I could just refer the court to a case called Lyre, and it's L-I-R-E, versus Bob's Pizza Inn Restaurants at 541 Northwest 2nd, 432. North Dakota law would not result in any different.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
On which issue?
On the whether there's a contract or not.
Okay. But XCO would have charged the 200% penalty if Capital Wireless had not agreed to participate.
That's right, and that is referred to in the first page of the agreement. The North Dakota statute requires a notice to be given, and it's the third to last paragraph in the letter where they notify the non-operating interest unit that they intend to assess a risk penalty if there's not an agreement to participate.
What if Capital Wireless had responded that, as you were talking about a while ago, had responded that, or put a specific provision in by their response that they did not intend to be bound by the letter agreement? Would that have triggered a 200% penalty?
Well, I would think at that point that then the ball would have been in XTO's court to either reach a further agreement or something.
Formal JOA.
That's right. But if there is not an agreement to participate, then the statute could kick in to allow the assessment. And that's an administrative type issue with the equivalent of the Railroad Commission, whatever that's called in North Dakota.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay. Rebuttal.
You know, to address in reply to Appellee's argument, first and foremost, I think that if you take the positions of Appellee on their face, that the argument that there's nothing, that somehow the appellants hadn't come in and proven that they had conditioned their conditioned all of this on a future document and conditioned or that they needed to come in and say, well, we're not accepting, any agreement that could be formed is subject to future documentation. I think it should be pointed out that turns the burden of proof on summary judgment on its head, because when you look at the drilling proposal, it's insufficient on its face to show that there's an agreement. If the document that they argue is the agreement isn't enforceable on its face, doesn't have adequate terms on its face, that burden doesn't shift to the non-movement on summary judgment to show that there's some condition preceding that hadn't been met. They have to show first that there are adequate terms to form
an enforceable agreement, and they have not done that.
Mr. Milner?
Yes.
Is it your client's position that it did not participate as a owner in the drilling of this well? Is it a non-participant under North Dakota law?
Well, I think that in terms of what the record before the court, there's a lack of that there was not an affirmative agreement shown for participation.
All right.
I think
is the way if you're not either a participant or you're a non-participant, you agree with me on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if your position is we don't have an agreement, then to me that would make you a non-participant.
Well, I think that it may be, when we look at it, if we're talking about a participant in terms of the North Dakota statute and when you get to impose a penalty, I think that that may be a slightly different issue. And certainly that's my understanding of how that works is that there's a election to participate, but it's not the same as, do we have an enforceable agreement? So when this letter is sent out, it's a notice of, hey, we want to know if you're going to elect to participate. And I think the way that, based on the evidence, to view this is to say, all right, we would like to participate. Let's talk about the terms. And that's why a proposed joint operating agreement was necessary. And you look at it, it's a proposed joint operating agreement that's going to be forthcoming. So when you say that it's proposed, it's something, you know, that to me says that it's something that remains to be negotiated. The terms still need to be hashed out.
All right. Tell me, what is the status of Township 149 North, Range 104 West, Section 28, and 149 Range 104, Section West 33, the proposed well? What's its status at the time of the filing of the lawsuit in the trial court?
My understanding is that it has been drilled and completed.
And it is a drilled and completed well as of today also, correct?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Now, the one last point I would like to make is that there was a question as to whether there was any evidence disputing title. And, Your Honor, I would state that whether or not there's evidence disputing title is irrelevant here because there is not competent evidence establishing what title is to begin with. There was no title opinion that was offered into the summary judgment record. The drilling proposal itself that was offered by the appellee specifically says it's subject to final division order title opinion. That was never presented. No other competent evidence has been presented. So even if it is, as appellee argues, which we don't agree, but even if it is that the pro rata percentage of cost based on working interest percentage is the standard by which this is to be judged, there's no evidence in the summary judgment record that's competent to show what that percentage would be so that you can determine what that pro rata portion of costs is. So based on these bases, we ask that the judgment be reversed.
You're asking for a reverse and remand for trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not a reverse and render?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your arguments and your excellent briefs. Interesting case. Your case is submitted, and you'll be hearing from us when the opinion is handed down. Thank you for coming, and you're excused, and we'll stand adjourned.